Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome back to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. A quick question for you. What do the following have in common? Oddjob from the James Bond classic Goldfinger, the legendary science fiction author Philip K. Dick, Kim Jong-un, and the slasher movie Friday the 13th. The answer is they all make appearances in Ed Park's long-awaited second novel, Same Bed, Different Dreams. This book is unlike any other book I've ever read, and that is a good thing. Ed keeps the reader in a state of delightful disorientation. I had to go online to determine which characters were real and which owed their existence to Ed's incredible imagination. Mind-bending questions started dancing in my head. Was there really a Korean provisional government? Are there really five kinds of different dreams? And that, my alphas, leads us to the title of Ed's book.
It's an old adage in Asia, very popular in Korea, that my father wrote to me in an email once, probably, I believe, in the 90s, so quite a while ago. And I don't even remember the context, but I just remember it being so evocative and poetic and just thinking that would be a great title for a book sometime. So it took, you know, another, let's say, 10 years at least before I was working on something that I thought might justify that title. And so Same Bed, Different Dreams, on the one hand, what I started out with in terms of the writing was, you know, a kind of a, maybe a comedy of family, a comedy of relationships. Same bed, different dreams, meaning you don't know what somebody else is thinking, even people very close to you, your family, your friends. The more I kind of thought about it, the more I realized this book is actually going to be a lot about Koreans in America, Korean history in general. I started thinking about that saying, same bed, different dreams, as kind of a metaphor for Korea itself, the country that kind of superpowers have projected their dreams onto. And of course, North and South Korea being in the same bed, being the same ethnicity, but having very different kind of national goals.
Mm-hmm. Very well said. So why did you decide to write such an expansive book covering three very different subjects, Korean history, American pop culture, and the impact that technology has on our lives? They could easily be like a trilogy. It could easily be three separate books.
Maybe it's just the way my mind works when I'm kind of in this creative mode. Your mind reaches for these memories. I don't think I'd really consciously thought of that show MASH for many years, but that was a huge part of me growing up and, you know, watching TV. It was in syndication. And I mean, there was at least a couple years where it was like on every day after school. And it's, so I just kind of thought, what a strange way for me. I was born in Buffalo, New York. My parents came from Korea in the late 60s. But I hadn't really visited Korea. I knew a little bit from them and what they had lived through and been through, including the Korean War. But then to watch Alan Alda and Jamie Farr, you know, these actors doing a show that was also kind of, I think, a commentary on Vietnam. You know, it was very confusing, but also a form of entertainment. So, you know, I found myself putting a lot of history into the book, but it's kind of only the good parts, only the stuff that has engaged me. And to think of MASH and other forms of pop culture, I did want it to be entertaining and even at times, you know, very, very funny. I am at heart, I think, a comic novelist. And so I'm trying to bring all these different elements together.
Mm-hmm. There's a lot of humor in your work, and I really appreciated that. I'm guessing that one of the biggest challenges you faced would have been weaving the different storylines together. Was that indeed the case?
It was, until it wasn't. If I can remember, you know, during the writing process, I'm kind of going on one of the plot lines is fairly linear, kind of the modern day. And then when I realize, oh, this character is going to be reading a book with this sort of outrageous alternative history of Korea, you know, my mind is kind of like, wait a second. I don't know if this is the same book. And then once it clicked, once I found a method of putting it in, something turns in my mind and I'm able to integrate it more. There are definitely, though, plenty of notebooks and kind of crazy looking charts where I'm plotting who's connected to whom. You know, there are fictional characters and then there are figures from history. There are elements from different, you know, movies and sitcoms and so forth. And to have them all connect in a satisfying way, there was a lot of, brain power and sweat involved in that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I can imagine there would be, but it was well worth it. I had to go online to figure out which characters were historical figures and which were not. So that was good research, kind of a good education for me.
Yeah.
And you mentioned blending fiction and nonfiction, and that's one of the great appeals of the book. But why did you decide to blend fiction and nonfiction?
Well, I think you can only tell certain parts of history, and I guess I'm talking about modern Korean history and how it dovetails with American history. In order to do that, you need to talk about certain figures, right? So one of the elements in the book is the very real group called the Korean Provisional Government, which was founded in 1919, kind of in protest to the Japanese occupation of Korea. They colonized Korea since 1910. And this is a real group that I read about years ago. And I would always, over the years, just kind of like, if there was a book on Korean history or, you know, the Korean War, whatever, I would look to in the index to see if there was any mention of it. And there was kind of scant mention. But I love this idea of a provisional government that actually, it's a figurehead. It doesn't really have any power. It's in exile, right? It's based in Shanghai. Syngman Rhee, who is living in Hawaii, is elected, you know, the head of it. And I just thought, this is a great idea for a novel, if I can then kind of expand that. And what if they actually did have power? What if they didn't dissolve, you know, in the 40s? What if they were still around today? So you can see how actual historical events, figures, entities sparked, they kind of got my creative juices flowing in this case. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And lucky for us as readers, the question, what is history, is a recurring motif in your novel. Why?
It's a big question, obviously, and I think it was a question to myself. The reader doesn't have to know this, but it was a question to myself. It's like, why is it that these things that I've read or that have been told to me, that I've watched, why have they stayed with me? Why do I think about sitting down and watching the series finale of MASH, which I think is still the most viewed non-sports event in broadcast history, right? Why do I remember when Korean Airlines Flight 007 was shot down in 1983 by the Soviets? Why do I remember thinking, how interesting that it was Flight 007 at the height of, you know, kind of my fascination with James Bond?
Yeah, and the odd job cameos. Sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off. I love the odd job cameos.
So in a way, it's sort of like, that is history too. And in asking that question, I believe it's the very first line of the book. It's almost like I wrote the book to answer that question, if that's not too tautological. It just felt right. It felt like the question to ask and a way to maybe address or resolve things that have been taking over my mind for most of my life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You mentioned earlier, one of your main characters is Soon Shin. Can you tell us a bit about him?
Yeah. So he was the first kind of voice in my head. And I was sitting in a house upstate alone with a typewriter, actually. And his voice just sort of emerged. And he worked for a big tech company called Gloat, which I had been walking in a park up there. And there was there was some company named GLOAB on a bench. Cool. They had dedicated a bench. And that kind of was churning in my mind. And I was like, who is this guy? Well, maybe the easy answer is he's a little bit like me. So I kind of made him roughly my age. He's going to be from Buffalo. His parents are from Korea. And that's where things diverged. But it had been a long time since my first novel, Personal Days, had come out. I kind of thought, well, maybe he's a writer who isn't a writer anymore. And maybe he works for a tech company, which, you know, obviously technology, big tech is always on our minds. I had worked for a couple of years for Amazon, so I had some thoughts about that. But, you know, in my mind, Gloat would be a combination of like several different companies. So it's got social media going on and all sorts of stuff. His character deepens over the many pages and stuff. But it was really sort of almost like a mirror version of myself and like an alternate life for myself. And I just, as a writer, you want to follow that whenever you feel it strongly.
Definitely, yeah. As a Canadian, I'm pretty much legally mandated to ask you about the third overtime of Game 6 of the 1999 Stanley Cup Finals between your hometown Buffalo Sabres and the Dallas Stars. Tell us what happened and why you decided to include this bit of hockey history.
You know, I was living in New York at the time. I've been in New York for a long time, but I was born and raised in Buffalo. For my sins, I followed the Buffalo Bills and the Buffalo Sabres. And, you know, and I didn't play football growing up, but I played hockey growing up. The Sabres have been to the finals twice. Okay. Once against the Flyers back in 74, 75, and then once against the Stars. And I remember, you know, watching that in triple overtime, as you say, Brett Hull's skate is clearly in the crease. He scores. And even though later, you know, I believe the NHL headquarters are like, yeah, his foot was in the crease. That shouldn't have been goal. It was too late. The cat was out of the bag. And so, you know, not long after that, I in a note to myself, just kind of playing around with certain obsessions, I thought that line about how the 1999 Stanley Cup Finals was never finished. And, you know, same with the Korean War, which is never actually, there was no actual peace treaty involved. And just like, what if somebody connected those two things? I threw that in there. And it, as you know, from reading it, it kind of opened up this rich vein of Sabres lore. You know, trying to connect that to the larger movements of the book was a lot of fun.
Mm-hmm. And a lot of fun to read. And you even have a little black and white shot, aerial view of Brett Hull's skate in the crease. So that was great. Yeah. How did the 1980 slasher film Friday the 13th find its way into Same Bed, Different Dreams?
So again, I believe sometime in the 1990s, I had read somewhere Kim Jong-il, who was the son of the founder of North Korea, Kim Il-sung, and the father of the current leader, Kim Jong-un, before he was elevated to the leader of North Korea, upon his father's death, he was a huge film buff. He not only had a huge personal collection of movies, but he wrote a lot about film production and how movies should be made. And I read somewhere that his favorite movie was Friday the 13th. And I actually hadn't watched it as a kid. I was a little bit afraid of slasher movies, to be honest. So I hadn't seen that, but that question always, I just thought, how interesting if true, right? Huge if true, as they say. But when I finally came around to watch it, I found it strangely, I mean, it was scary, it was violent, but there was something like kind of entrancing about it. And almost like aesthetically, I was like trying to put myself in his mind, like how would a dictator, like what would he, what would he grasp? And anyway, it was only upon reading this biography, you know, for the millionth time, I noticed a detail about his early life that there was this aha moment where I was like, oh, I have a theory why this could have been his favorite movie, like why he would have responded to it. So I felt kind of duty bound to include that in the novel itself. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm so glad you did. I was really struck by the sentence, war is a form of time travel. That kind of really resonated with me. What does that mean to you?
I was just reading a story the other day by my late friend, Gabe Hudson, who had been a rifleman in the first Gulf War. This idea that, you know, you go back to the Iliad, you go back before the Iliad, like war is horribly part of the human condition. And I think there is that sense that it kind of never goes away. And in a horrible way, it connects you with earlier times. And even, you know, thinking about all the violence in the world today, and then, you know, having to read from my book or talk about my book to revisit what happened during the Korean War is just like, it's horrible. War is just this kind of fact of life and fact of civilization, I guess, that doesn't go away.
Yeah, very well said. What do you want people to take away from reading Same Bed, Different Dreams?
I hope it's a reading experience unlike any you've ever had. I mean, there are obviously books and authors that I admire and that I look up to, but I was really trying to write something that would be fun to read and fascinating, hopefully, but also kind of structured in a way that would not just keep you on your toes, but make you kind of eager to read the next section to see kind of like, how is he going to tell this part of the story? Beyond that, I would hope people laugh because, as I said, I do work hard on some of these some of these jokes. And also to think about that question, what is history? So for me, perhaps it's, you know, in writing this book, looking at Buffalo Sabres history, Korean War, you know, the my ancestral lands, both Buffalo and Korea. But also, like, I would hope that the reader would come away with his or her own take on that question, like to look within themselves and, you know, wonder about what did my parents go through? What did my grandparents go through? How am I here? That is, I believe that is history too. And that is a little bit grandiose, but I think that is what drove me to write a book like this.
Mm-hmm. And we're so thankful that you did write it. Ed Park, thank you very much for joining us today. Congratulations on Same Bed, Different Dreams. It's one of the most totally original, incredibly immersive novels that I've ever read.
Thank you so much, Doug. This was a real pleasure, a real treat.
Ed Park is the author of the novel Same Bed, Different Dreams. Find out more at WPR.org/beta. Well, that does it for this edition of Beta. Thanks to our guests, Billy D. Williams, M.D. Dunn, and Ed Park.
What you're gleaning from these interviews is groundbreaking.
Don't forget to subscribe to Beta on Apple Podcasts or wherever you catch your favorite pods. Be sure to offer a rating. That'll help us build our alpha army. And you can keep up with us during the week online at WPR.org/beta.
Oh, I gotta get on that internet. I'm late on everything.
Beta is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Red Meat Productions.
Fantastic.
Our music and technical director is Steve Gotcher.
He is only one of over 60 weird and strange creatures to emerge out of the fantasies of the men and women who work here.
Our executive producer is Adam Friedrich.
Charming, cavalier, roguish kind of character, you know, who's out there.
And thanks to you, our alphas. More Beta comes your way next week. Until then, I'm Doug Gordon.
I didn't look for work. I just sort of locked myself away and just read books.